The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic that has been kind of in my thoughts in this past week or so has been this recognition that around how much our intentions are the kind of the engine, the constructor of what goes on in our lives. Our intentions shape our lives. And there are different levels of intention. I'll offer three different kind of words. One being aspiration. You know, what are our larger aims in our life? What's the kind of the direction we'd like to go? And the second level is more along the lines of motivation. You know, kind of in our lives, what are our motivations for our actions? And then the finest level. And these three levels are each expressed in the Buddhist teaching with a different word that I'll refer to as we go. And the most fine-grained level is that every single moment, every single split second of experience, there's some kind of impulse to move, to act, to speak, a kind of a motivation of the mind to kind of create the actions of our lives. And each of those impulses, this momentary impulses, also has a kind of a spin to it, a kind of a direction based on kind of the motivation from which that very fine impulse arises. And so that's the finest level of intention. So what this points to partly is that everything that we do, everything that we say, all of our actions are grounded in kind of the mind. The mind is motivating what we do. There's a teaching of this and a famous kind of quote from the Buddhist teachings that's goes like, it's from the Dhammapada. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, with a mind of anger, aversion, confusion. And suffering follows, like the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. And this points to how there's both that there is a kind of a conditioned nature to our actions, that how we are internally affects how we are externally, and also what we experience. It's not just about how we act, it's how we are. That this teaching says all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. And so it's an important exploration for us to begin to be curious about what is motivating us, what is driving our actions. So it's useful to reflect on this to some extent, both at the large level, the level of aspiration and the kind of larger arc of our life, and at the more fine level. Usually what I would say, I mean, that there is this kind of conditioned nature that our actions are motivated by some kind of, our actions are kind of preceded or there's an impulsion from our mind to our actions, whether we are aware of it or not. This is not just about our conscious intentions. Because a large part of why we get so caught up in our struggling and in our confusion is because there are unseen motivations going on in our hearts and our minds. these motivations are, when we're not aware of what's, you know, kind of under the surface here, when we're not aware of what's kind of going on in the deeper levels of our mind, we are generally motivated and acting out of our habitual conditioning, what we've been trained to do, what we have done in the past. And so this kind of conditioning that we have, you know, the way our families were, the way we were when we were growing up, our cultures, reactivity that we've... So there's some of that, and then there's some of the kind of just human conditioning that there's the kind of ways in which we're shaped individually by our families, by who we are, by how we come into the world, by our own bodies. I mean, myself, for instance, I have a few food sensitivities. You know, this body can't tolerate certain foods, and so that affects me. It's like it's not something that I can change, but it is a condition. And so there's some conditions that affect us that are very personal, very individual. And then there are conditions that affect us in a kind of a more personal way, kind of a familial way. And then there are conditions that affect us in terms of a larger cultural views, opinions, beliefs from our culture. And then there are what I'd say just human perspectives that shape us. Some of those human perspectives I talk about a lot. I'll just, you know, name them kind of briefly, and that is this kind of very human, natural phenomenon of if something's pleasant, we like it, we want it. We want to move towards it. We grasp after it. If something's unpleasant, we want to get rid of it. We want to push it away. And that's also a very human conditioning, because in our human experience, we have learned over and over again that when I get something that I want, it feels good. When I get rid of something that I don't want, it feels good. And so we get a little hit of, oh, that's right, that feels good. That must be the way to be happy, is to get what I want and get rid of what I don't want. And so in some ways, our human experience conditions us towards this pattern of moving towards pleasant, wanting it, holding to it, clinging, grasping, pushing away unpleasant, aversion, hatred, hostility, that those natural movements are conditioned, because when we act on that kind of movement of wanting and we get something we want, whew, we get a feeling of relief, of release. It feels good. It doesn't last very long. It's kind of momentary, but It's a little bit of a relief. And on the other side, too, with the aversion, when we figure out how to get rid of something, control our experience in some way to not be associating with something unpleasant, it feels good to have that sense of control. There's a relief, a release of, I figured it out. I know how to do this. And that is very much on a human level what has conditioned a lot of our actions. That's that simple process. And as a human being, you know, unless we explore more deeply in our minds and in our hearts, we basically think that that little moment of getting something that I want, the relief, the release that comes from that, the little moment of release, a feeling of control when I get rid of something that I don't want, we think that's that is happiness. That is as good as it gets. And so our minds don't recognize through the kind of natural engagement with the world, unless somebody comes and talks to us and says, hey, you know, that little moment, that's pretty impermanent. And you might look at what happens if you engage in a different way. And this is essentially what the Buddha has been teaching, what the Buddha taught. He discovered in his own mind this movement, this human conditioning isn't as good as it gets. This human kind of perspective or belief around greed and aversion, that there is a deeper kind of happiness available, a more reliable, in some ways, kind of happiness that comes not from holding on to wanting to control, to fix, to change, but from a letting go. And so this conditioning, we're usually oriented towards this movement. Our actions is usually, when we're not aware, it's motivated by our habitual conditioning. And not just our personal conditioning, but our human conditioning. And so I bring in the human conditioning piece here right at the beginning, because, you know, We all share this. You know, it's not something we have to feel ashamed of, but it is something when we begin to learn about it that we can turn the direction in a new way towards a different approach to living. And this question of aspiration, what is it that motivates us? Through even a little bit of a reflection can help us to recognize sometimes when we are acting in ways, when our motivations are kind of not in line with what our broader aspirations are. So that's the first piece I'd like to explore a little bit and talk about. It's like, what are your deepest aspirations? I think as human beings we do. I think there's also this very deep wish in our hearts for well-being, for happiness, not only for ourselves but for others. And this is a beautiful wish, you know, connecting with what is the deepest inner wish for ourselves and for our fellow human beings. For you, you know, what is that? It's useful to reflect on that. Taking some time to, you know, you might just start, you know, as I speak, maybe now, just let it kind of wash through you. What are you most inspired by? Where does your heart feel like it sings, like it's like, yeah, that's the direction that this being just has a kind of not a constricted movement to. I'm not talking about, you know, the wanting here. The feeling of aspiration has more of a feeling of softness and openness. And the feeling of wanting has a feeling of constriction. And so that's the place I'm encouraging you to explore, is where does it feel like the heart opens as you reflect on what is your deepest aspiration? This kind of reflection can be useful to do regularly, because there are ways that we might begin to touch into some kind of obvious ones initially, like, yeah, I want to be happy, or so that may be one, and then you know, underneath a little bit more might be, I'm wanting to be engaged in the world. It's not just about me being happy, but there's something about wanting to help or be of service. Maybe there's something like that there too. I mean, there's just deeper. We all have different. There's no right answer. I want to say that. This motivation or this aspiration will have different flavors for everybody. And it's kind of like an individual expression of that will look very different. If you're living by your deepest aspiration, what one person looks like when living by their deepest aspiration looks very different than what another person looks like when they're living by their deepest aspiration. I've met this one monk that I'm thinking of in the moment. When I spent a number of years going to Burma, over and over again, I got to know some of the monks that lived in the hills, in the Sagaing Hills in Upper Burma and Middle Burma. And the very first time I met him, I'm going to paint this picture for you. It was very powerful for me, the experience. There were a group of us walking in the hills. This area is just, it's basically a lot of monasteries, about 700 monasteries in this area, in this hill country in Burma. And most of the paths in those hills are walking paths. They're very old walking paths. A lot of them have been paved by old stones. And so there's this, you know, just these walking paths. And a group of us were going to visit this monk that I had never met before, but my friends had been there before. So we were all kind of walking and chatting. While we were walking, it took probably about 20, 25 minutes to get to this monastery. And as we approached the the kind of gate of the monastery, the main person who was leading us, who was guiding us, he had been a monk, or he might have even been a monk at that point. And he turned to us and reminded us, he said, you know, this monastery is really, really quiet, and we need to come into silence as we enter the gate. So we all stopped chatting and talking, and that was a little bit of a reminder to me to be present in that moment. And as we walked through that gate, this monastery was kind of in a bowl. There were cliffs on three sides of the monastery, and we were kind of walking in the fourth side, and the cliffs had been whitewashed so that the rainwater could be used in catchment. And so I walked in and looked up at these cliffs towering above me in white. And the feeling as I walked into this place, when I was walking, it was palpable. I was walking into this thick peace, this thick silence. It had a palpable feeling. It brought me right into presence, just being in this monastery, having walked into the gate. And then we met the monk. And he was a very quiet monk. You know, he did not go outside of the monastery very much. He was available to have conversations when people came to him. And I just, you know, I just liked sitting with him. He was so peaceful. It's just like, I felt like this transmission of peace. And then we would, you know, at some point he said in Burmese to our translator, would you like to ask any questions? And so we would ask some questions and he would respond and we would have this exchange. And we did this several times during the course of my time there. And I was just so happy sitting in his presence. To my sense of him was that he was living his deepest aspiration. And it wasn't a big thing. It was just what felt most resonant for him. And as I left that monastery, I was talking to my friend Carol Wilson, who was one of the people who was on this trip with us, and I turned to Carol, who was my mentor and teacher, and I said to her, you know, I'm not usually very sensitive to, you know, being attuned to things, you know, it's like, but boy, and I described to her what I described to you, how I felt like I'd walked into this palpable sense. And she turned to me and she said, you know, it's not subtle here. It is really obvious here, you know. And so to some extent, I was feeling what was a little more obvious in this place, this feeling of peace, this feeling of centeredness and connection. And so I tell that story because, you know, that person, that monk, he wasn't a big teacher. You know, he didn't have books written. His name is Sayadaw Ujjayanta. You've probably never heard of him. He had a huge impact on me. I know he's had a huge impact on many people who've met him. He's had an impact on those of us who went to visit him. And to some extent, that impact, you know, it ripples out into the world. And so that expression is the right expression for that person. And then there's another side of it is like, you know, Gandhi, who had a very different expression of his being, you know, his deepest aspiration, his deepest intention to, and that created, you know, it was very active, very out in the world. And so I say that because, you know, we might have some idea of what it might look like to be acting in a most congruent way for us and think, oh, I should model myself after that person or that person. And what I'd encourage is like really doing the inquiry. What is the most congruent aspiration for you? How can you live your life in line with that aspiration? In the teachings of the Buddha, the word that's most connected with this word aspiration in some ways is the word adhittana, Pali word adhittana, which is often translated as something like resolve or determination. And it means direction in a way. Like, what is our compass? What is our star? What is our guiding star? What are our guiding principles? And in one teaching, the Buddha points to four aspirations that are beautiful aspirations to live our life by. And these aspirations, he kind of points to various aspirations here, these four, they can be expressed in many ways. And so that's another piece to look at, is not only what the aspiration is, but how does this being want to express that aspiration? And so these four are wisdom, having an aspiration in the direction of wisdom, of understanding, having an aspiration in the direction of truth, being committed to truth, organizing our life in the direction of that kind of aim, to relinquishment, letting go. I'll talk more about that in a little while. Hopefully I'll have time for that. Letting go. Essentially pointing to the letting go around the habitual movements that we have thought were useful to finding a deeper happiness. But seeing actually that a deeper kind of happiness is possible through letting go. This is the relinquishment that's pointed to here. And then peace, the fourth adhittana, the fourth aspiration. And so exploring that, you know, what are we motivated by? What are our aspirations? What is our guiding principle? And then beginning to reflect, are my actions, what I actually do in my life, is it guided by that? Is it supported by that? When we have a sense of our deeper intention, we can begin to look at our lives and see, are there ways that what I do in my life can come into alignment with that deeper aspiration? Now, we may have lofty ideas about what that might mean. So, like, if I have a deeper aspiration of kindness or peace, what might that look like? Oh, I have to get out there and be a big presence in the world, or I don't know, we might have ideas about that. But another way to engage with this is to look at what we're already doing in our lives and seeing, can this intention begin to infuse what I'm already doing? So a simple example. We have to go to the grocery store every day, or once a week, we have to go to the grocery store kind of frequently. And we might think of that as just something that we have to do. It's like, well, going to the grocery store, that's not connected to my deepest aspiration in life. And yet, how might it be? How might it be? This kind of expression, where we connect a simple activity to our deepest wishes, can have a powerful impact on our lives. And so going to the grocery store, if you reflect, not just, oh, I need to go to the grocery store, oh, it's a little bit of a chore, it's like, oh, I've got to do this, I'm kind of in a rush, it's squished between these other things, and I'm kind of annoyed, and there's a long line, and all of this. So we're kind of oriented in our habitual way, potentially, because we're not observing and noticing what is the motivation here. It's just the habitual motivation. It's the conditioned motivation for going to the grocery store. And yet if we're conscious about it, if we become interested in how might my deepest wish, my deepest aspiration be reflected by going to the grocery store, perhaps a sense of peace or kindness might be one's deepest aspiration. And, you know, consciously connecting with that as an intention as we enter into the grocery store, you know, that might have a powerful impact on how you are in the grocery store. Being kind to the other people in the grocery store, being kind to the cashier, maybe letting somebody ahead of you who has fewer items than you in the line. Just simple, simple actions of kindness and engaging in your own being with peace. That is bringing that action to have a connection with that deeper wish. And so that simple things like that, you know, simple things like that can really begin to inform us. And we can also, having this interest or inclination around what our intentions are, what our aspirations are, can begin to point out where we may be engaging in habitual intentions in an activity that is kind of neutral. So one day, not too long ago, I was doing dishes, and I was noticing a little bit of, you know, impatience as I was doing it. It's like, I got something else to do. And that impatience kind of was a little bit of a wake-up bell. And what came into my mind in that moment was, I have no idea how long I have left on this planet. And this is a truth. We don't know. Might have been another minute, or maybe I have another 18, 25 years. I don't know how long I have. But in that moment, there was that recollection of, I don't know how long I have. And is this how I want to live? If this is my last moment with this impatience in my mind doing this activity. And immediately there was much more of a sense of peace and a relinquishment, a letting go of that impatience. It's like, yeah, this is what I'm doing in this moment. If this is my last moment, I'd like it to be one of ease and peace. And so connecting to our intention, our kind of aspiration, what is our deepest wish, can begin to shift how we are in relationship to our actions. And also potentially even begin to point out to us, you know, this thing that I'm doing right now, browsing the internet with habitual, like, greed, is not in line with my deepest aspiration. And maybe that can support a letting go of activities and intentions and movements that are not necessary, and beginning to recognize, well, am I living life? Am I doing things that are in line with this priority, with this aspiration? Am I prioritizing my life in connection with those aspirations? And Gil offered a practice, and he offered this a long time ago. I don't know if he's talked about it lately, but I remember it from probably, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. He said one of the practices he does in daily life is, he called it calendar practice. In the morning, he would look at his calendar and think about, what is it that I have to do today? And as I was thinking about giving this talk, I thought about that. And it's like, okay, what is it that I have to do today? And his instruction was, and what is the intention I want to connect with each of those actions? So going to the grocery store, I do have to go to the grocery store today. What is the intention I want to bring to that action? Or meeting with a friend, what is the intention I want to bring to that? What are the things I need to do, and how do I want to connect? That practice, if you kind of take 5 minutes each morning and think about what you have to do and what might be an intention that is connected to the deeper wish of your life, that can have an influence on how you are in your day. And so exploring that possibility. Knowing that the Dalai Lama had a beautiful expression at one point. He said, you know, my religion is kindness. And that might be looked at as one of his aspirations of how to live his life. And you watch the Dalai Lama, and that is how he is. Apparently, he, in going places, he has a big impact on people because he's so kind and he's so there with people. When there's a big event, he apparently makes an effort to thank the people and talk to the people who are, the people that most big presences, big name people would not meet. Like he'd find the janitors and he'd find the people who had to support the event and say, thank you so much for helping. Thank you for your service. And that kind of kindness was palpable. Like I felt that walking into the monastery. That kind of kindness with the Dalai Lama is palpable because he's so present and it's so intentional. And he means it. It's not just surface. It's coming from deep within. And his instruction to us is, whenever possible, be kind. And it is always possible. So that's a kind of reminder to us of a connection to a deeper wish in our lives. And something that we also have to acknowledge and recognize is that we will see that when we're motivated, when we're acting, doing things, there are times when we, as we're getting more and more familiar with our the possibility of being mindful and being aware of the undercurrents, we'll see undercurrents that are not so beautiful. We'll see the motivation of greed. I want this thing. No, I don't want to be mindful of this because I really want it. Or, aversion. Yeah, I really, that person is to blame and I don't want to let go of that. So we'll see that kind of movement in our hearts. And part of being kind is not to then tell ourselves something like that undercurrent of aversion or greed has to go away. It's bad, it's wrong. But to be kind to ourselves and recognize, ooh, that undercurrent of greed or aversion is there. And how can it be held with kindness? That's a different approach. It's a different approach than having the sense of, I have to repress it. This movement to explore. I think that this sometimes is the middle way, that when we see these undercurrents that are motivating us in ways that are not so helpful, that we explore the possibility of neither expressing nor repressing. This is the kind action in our hearts to hold it, to acknowledge it. And that possibility gives us the possibility to begin to potentially not act out of some of those movements. And this all kind of points to, in our lives, the motivations. We have so many habitual motivations, so many, things that we've been conditioned by. And as we start to bring mindfulness to our what's going on in our minds, one of the functions, I think, of mindfulness, I sometimes talk about, as we become mindful, it begins to lower the horizon of what we think of as our subconsciousness. And we start to see these motivations. And holding them in a different way begins to be a possibility. And as we hold them in a different way, the Buddha also encouraged us to begin to explore encouraging and cultivating what he called wise intention. And this is the word here is sama, which means wise or right, skillful, onward leading, directing us towards happiness, in a deeper kind of happiness. Sama has that meaning. And sankappa means something like thought or intention or motivation. And the teaching in the Eightfold Path, wise intention or wise motivation, is motivated by wise view, wise understanding. And this is a truth, actually, that in general, our intentions, our motivations, are kind of sculpted by our views, our opinions, our beliefs. And so that's another layer down, actually, that we start to see as we start to kind of, the horizon of the subconscious begins to get lower and lower. One level we see is our motivations. We see the, I want that, or I want to get rid of that, or this is what's important. This is how I engage in the world. And then as it starts to get lower, as the horizon of the subconscious starts to get lower with mindfulness, we also start to see the underlying views and beliefs that inform those motivations. And so the Buddha pointed to there is a wise view that supports us in our practice, a view that basically is kind of centered around understanding how suffering happens in our hearts and minds, and recognizing, kind of a resistance to a simple way to explore wise view is kind of that we generally have a resistance to three truths. And wise view is more orienting or aligning with these truths. But in resisting that things are impermanent, unreliable, and uncontrollable, in resisting the impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable nature of of what's going on in the world, we suffer. Things are largely, what we're engaged in the world is there's a lot of experience that is impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable, and when we're resisting the truth of that, we are suffering. And so wise view kind of helps bring us into alignment with those truths. There are many different ways to express wise view, but that's just one that I'll bring in right now. And the intentions that can arise as we start to orient towards what is it that helps us let go of that resistance to those truths? What is it that helps orient us in the direction of freedom from suffering? We begin to see what gets us caught by suffering as we explore that. And in intention, in this teaching on wise intention or wise motivation, the Buddha pointed to three basic motivations and counter-motivations, that we're habitually motivated by ill will, sometimes motivated by cruelty, and often motivated by wanting to get what we want. And the counter, or the kind of other side to it, is that the possibility of being motivated by non-ill will or love, be motivated by non-cruelty or compassion, kindness, compassion, and being motivated by, instead of holding on to things, letting go. And he pointed to this in his own practice. He said, as I was sitting and meditating, I saw that, the things that came up in my heart, they were either motivated by these intentions towards ill will towards cruelty or sense desire, or to non-ill will, non-cruelty, non-sense desire, or relinquishment. And he said, I saw that when I kind of followed the ones motivated by ill will, by cruelty, and by sense desire, ultimately it created tension in the heart, sometimes full-on suffering, but some form of affliction, some form of constriction. And that when I followed or allowed the actions or the thoughts, the things that were arising based on the non-ill will, non-cruelty, and on relinquishment, there was a releasing, a letting go. And this, what he said is, you know, I could think those thoughts that were based in non-ill will, non-cruelty, and relinquishment, it would not hurt anybody. It would not cause harm in the world. And so that's the direction. Began to understand that's the direction to go. And so exploring that, you know, non-ill will, kindness, basically. Kindness not only externally, but internally. Last week I gave a talk basically pointing to how being aware of our experience can be an expression of kindness. And so there's the outer exploration of being kind in relationship to other beings, other people. And then there's kindness in our hearts towards ourselves. Opening to our experience with wise attention that can be experienced as kind attention or loving attention. And so that's an expression of this aspiration. Can be an expression of this deeper aspiration, one of our deeper aspirations. Just kindness to ourselves. And non-cruelty, you know, connecting with the intention of compassion in our actions. Again, externally and internally. The third one that he points to here. And so, you know, in some ways I look at the teachings on the adhidhanas, the determinations, the resolves, the aspirations of wisdom, truth, of relinquishment, and of peace as being kind of the aim or the direction. And the motivations here as being how do we act to head us in that direction? And so non-ill will or kindness, non-cruelty or compassion. And renunciation is the word there, which supports a relinquishment. And so compassion. Compassion in the face of suffering. Kindness and compassion are similar in some ways. Kindness is more the kind of expression of a heart that is not fighting or kind of too wrapped up in itself in some ways. You know, the heart that is open, receptive, meets the world and kind of naturally has a sense of, I hope you're happy. I hope you're happy. I hope you have a life of ease. Even to, you know, a lizard or a spider. And much less than to, you know, a human being. You know, we see, you know, people driving, and today, you know, a couple people kind of cut me off, and the first movement was one of, you know, kind of almost like anger and applying towards them intentions and motivations, and it's like, can there be some movement of kindness and letting go there? You know, back off on the accelerator instead of trying to keep them from merging into my lane. Let them have that space. The third one of renunciation, you know, renunciation, that word even, in our, it's like it does not have a very good reputation in our culture. usually it's got some connotation of something like letting go of something that I want, something like that. You know, that it means that I can't have something that I want. That's what our idea of renunciation is. Exactly, something like that. You know, the kind of the sense of somehow not doing something that you want is somehow, that's what relinquishment is. And it's not, it's actually not just us in our culture. It's kind of a human thing, because even at the time of the Buddha, this question of renunciation was like, you know, one layperson came to the Buddha and said, you know, renunciation, you know, I'm on board with some of this other stuff, but renunciation, you know, it just doesn't. I'll read his words. Venerable sir, we are householders who indulge in sensuality, delight in sensuality, enjoy sensuality, rejoice in sensuality. For us, indulging in sensuality, delighting in sensuality, renunciation seems like a sheer drop-off. Yet I've heard that in this Dharma, in your teaching, the hearts of the very young monks leap up at renunciation, grow confident and steadfast, seeing it as peace. So right here is where this teaching is contrary to the great mass of people, that of renunciation. This is 2,600 years ago, so, you know, this is, it's a human kind of sense of, you know, I want what, again, I talked about that movement, to want to get what we want, to want to get rid of what we don't want. Like, the idea of that letting go of sense desire is counter to so much of what we think of as happiness. And the Buddha acknowledged this. He said, kind of with a bit of poignancy, as I read this, he said, so it is, you know. I feel ya, is what I hear him saying. I feel ya. Even myself, before I had my awakening, I thought, renunciation is good, seclusion is good, but my heart did not leap up at renunciation and seclusion. The thought occurred to me. So understanding, so he had this recognition, you know, that there is a kind of, it seems helpful to let go of that pull, but my heart doesn't leap up to it. So what's going on there? So he began investigating. And he said, it occurred to me, what is the cause? Why doesn't my heart leap up at renunciation, seeing it as peace? And he said, the thought occurred to me, I haven't seen the drawback of sense pleasures, and I haven't seen the benefits of renunciation. And so he began an investigation. And I believe in this sutta, it says, and sometime later, the Buddha became awakened. And so this was not something that, like, he saw as like, oh, I need to understand the drawback of sense pleasure. Oh, boom, done. I need to understand the rewards of renunciation. Oh, okay, I understand that. It took time. An exploration of where is the pull towards sense pleasure? Where is the, what is the understanding of the rewards of renunciation? And it begins by exploring, where do we have this pull, push-pull around pleasant and unpleasant? Because this movement towards sense pleasure is that movement towards needing, desiring to have things to be the way I want them to be. Needing to have this like string of pleasant experiences, which includes this string of getting rid of unpleasant experiences, because the getting rid of the unpleasant is felt as pleasant. And so we have this kind of movement in that direction. And so beginning to watch what's actually going on there, and understanding the drawbacks of desiring sense pleasure happens. Not because we think about it, but because we see with mindfulness, as we begin to observe that wanting underneath, we start to see, you know, the way this whole thing works in our minds is that when we want something, our minds are kind of creating a little world in which we have the thing that we want. And our minds are kind of, they've taken up residence in that thought. That fantasy, oh, it's going to be so great when I get that thing. Watch this in your own experience, how this works. And in that, we are not present in the present moment for the experience of wanting and the feeling of lack that's there when we don't have what we want. We are in the fantasy of the having. This is one way it works. There are different ways that this works. one kind of expression of how this happens, that when we take up residence in that fantasy, the fantasy is pleasant, but the fantasy is a complete construction of our minds. It's not real. It's not present in our experience. But we've learned in some ways that when we think pleasant thoughts, it feels good. And so that's a big way that we move in our lives. We let ourselves come out of the present moment to fantasize because it feels good. And in very fast, tumbling ways, this kind of fantasizing happens when we want something. And so we are missing in that moment. We're living in this idea of, oh, it's going to be great when I get that thing. And essentially we are missing that actually right in the present moment, in this moment, there is a constriction. The wanting itself is a painful experience. The wanting itself hurts. The feeling of lack and the feeling of that wanting are unpleasant. And we're missing that because we're in the fantasy. And so one of the drawbacks of sense pleasure, of the desire for sense pleasure, not of sense pleasure itself. Sense pleasure comes and goes. There's no drawback to sense pleasure itself. It's the desire for it, the kind of the way we engage with it. And so that movement towards sense pleasure is essentially keeping us from recognizing the kind of detrimental effect that both greed and aversion have on us. This is one of the drawbacks of the desire of sense pleasure. We may be giving ourselves gastritis and completely, you know, unaware of the, you know, the way in which our mind is taking us out of that present moment experience. And so we begin to recognize that the drawback of that, of that sense desire, is that it takes us out of the present moment and seeing actually the suffering that happens in that experience. And the rewards of renunciation, and I'll just say this in a few seconds, and maybe when I come back, I'm teaching a retreat, maybe when I come back in a few weeks, I'll talk about renunciation more fully. The reward of renunciation is that when we actually watch wanting without acting on it, when we watch aversion without acting on it, there can be a release that happens. The letting go of the wanting, the letting go of the aversion. Not a letting go of our understanding of that thing is maybe unjust or that thing is a useful accomplishment, but letting go of the kind of the constriction around it, the constriction that comes with the desire and aversion. As we let go of that, there is an inner releasing and happiness that's a deeper kind of happiness that then comes from getting rid of. So this is one of the benefits of renunciation. And so exploring that possibility. And we explore that by being aware, as the Buddha, you know, sometime later it said, as he began to explore this, what are the drawbacks of sense pleasure? What are the benefits of letting go? We begin to feel it in our system. As we explore it with mindfulness, our system begins to help us move in the direction of letting go because it understands at a very deep level that that is a direction towards well-being and happiness. So it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention.